The great founder of Hasidism, a movement of religious revival, ecstasy, enthusiasm, which kindled so many of the lives of our fathers in Eastern Europe in the 18th and 19th century. The great founder of Hasidism, Israel, the Baal Shem Tov, refused throughout his life to set down his teachings on paper. He felt that wisdom, counsel, had meaning only in a particular environment, in a specific context, when it was spoken face to face. That when you set down your philosophy, your wisdom, on cold type, it lost its immediacy. You couldn't read the particular context of ideas which surrounded it, the spirit in which was said. And somehow any line which appears in type tends to be lifeless and tends to be distorted, misshapen, because we read it in a spirit which is not necessarily the spirit in which it was said. And it's interesting when we look back upon those men and women whose spiritual personalities have impressed mankind. But so many of them were shared Israel's conviction and refused to set down in their lifetime the wisdom, the obvious wisdom which is theirs. One thinks of Gautama, the Buddha. One thinks of Zoroaster, the great founder of Persian dualism. One thinks of Jesus. All of them men whose lives, whose personalities transformed the lives of millions of men. Each of whom, a man who refused in his lifetime to set down his store of knowledge and wisdom, lest it be distorted. So of all of these men, we have only legends, hearsay, second-hand evidence of their teaching. What their disciples or the children of their disciples reported they had heard this man say at a particular moment in time. I had occasion recently, in preparation for this program of adult Jewish education on the development of modern Jewry, for the section which we were just completing on Hasidism, to reread a little book which is called the Shivchei HaBesht, the Praise of the Baal Shem Tov. It was compiled in the year 1814, 54 years after Israel Baal Shem Tov's death, of the legends and stories and bits of biography which circulated about the master among his disciples and which had been passed down from city to city, from generation to generation, from word of mouth to word of mouth. And I found among these stories this little vignette. A demon appeared to the Baal Shem. And the Baal Shem was surprised at the look of the spirit because he carried a book under his arm. And he asked him, "What is this book?" And the answer came back, "It's your own writings." And the Baal Shem knew from the answer that one of his disciples was keeping a journal of his teachings. So he summoned them together and he said, "Which of you is keeping a diary of my sayings?" And the diary was brought. The man who had taken it down had thought he was doing an act of reverence, of piety for the master to enshrine his teachings. But the Baal Shem said, after he'd read the book, "There's nothing here that I said. There's nothing here that's mine. This is all an invention." And as I read this vignette and thought of what we've said already this morning, I was reminded of those moments in my own life when someone spoke to me words of wisdom which not only made a deep impression, but changed the direction, the course of my days. I tried once or twice to express this teaching to someone else, and even as I did, I found it to seem commonplace, to seem almost banal, because the meaning was in the moment. The meaning of these words were in my need. There was nothing unusual about them. How much new is there in terms of human wisdom? What was new was my need. And what was wise was the ability of that man to respond to my need, bidvar bito, with the appropriate word at the appropriate moment. And when we lay these proverbs, this conventional wisdom, this deep insight bare in book form, it suddenly appears to be somehow commonplace, and we lose the sense of its urgency. Chassidism is a great faith of storytelling, because storytelling is the one way man has to create again the envelope of environment, the situation in which the devar bito, the appropriate word at its appropriate moment, is spoken. We can quickly sketch in the players. We can suggest the mood, melancholy, exaltation, joy, fear, trembling, whatever it be. And by our imagination applying itself to the story, we can recreate in our own minds the moment in which a master, a guru, a teacher spoke, and spoke wisely in the effect that it had on a person. There are two kinds of wisdom in our world. One is analytic, logical. One seeks to reduce everything to simple equations, which are always theoretically true. There's another wisdom, which is more flexible, which deals in paradox, which deals in depth and certain degrees of uncertainty. And that's the wisdom that deals with the relationships of men to men. The first wisdom deals in the relationship of man to nature, natural law, the inevitable mathematical equations which describe the world about us. But when we come to understand our relationships to each other, there are no fixed immutable laws, only moments. And each person being the unique being that he is or she is, each requires a particular understanding or insight at a particular moment in time. Martin Buber, the great modern theologian who was the first to really popularize the Hasidim in the West, used to describe Hasidism as the way of meeting rather than the way of meaning. And by that he meant that Hasidism sought through these stories, through these vignettes, by retelling the legends of the master rather than by laying bare the reasoning of the master, that Hasidism tried to explain how men could relate in love, in friendship, deeply to another human being or to God, the moments of meeting, rather than the scientific laws, the laws, supposed laws of personal growth and of relationship, because those Hasidism believes to be really non-existent, or at least to have no immediate application to the issue at hand. Hasidism is a way of meeting. And Hasidism emphasizes the story, the legend, the tale of the master or of the masters in order to suggest to us a moment, a particular way of looking at a particular problem and of dealing with it. Stories to the Hasidim are healing. I found in the Shivchei HaBesht a strange question, a question I suspect could only have been answered to asked of such a man. A disciple came to him and said, "My master, teach me how to heal with a story." How does a story heal? It heals if somehow we can see ourselves in that story. And we can take the wisdom of another mother speaking to another child, of another teacher speaking to another person in need, and somehow relate it to an immediate episode, to immediate issue or incident in our own lives. On Saturday afternoon, the third meal of the Sabbath day, it was the custom of the Hasidim to gather around the table in the master's court, and the master would sit down at table with his disciples, and he would teach them with story, with parable, with legend. Now, you don't leave such a lesson with the feeling, I have now a new insight which makes everything fall into place. But sometimes you leave that kind of learning situation feeling, I know best now how to solve a particular problem in my own life. And the Hasidim, in their love of story, even added a fourth meal to the Sabbath day, the Malave Malka. And at that meal, the disciples would speak, and they would recount the great wonder tales of the great masters, all the miracles they had performed with this kind of existential wisdom, the way of meeting. And somehow, by recounting the great miracles of other grand, noble, spiritual persons, they felt that they too could tap the power of their own personality, that they were more than ordinary human beings. They drew from the strength of the legends strength for their own lives. It's strange, the power that exists in a story. We think of stories today largely as entertainment, as a way to pass an idle moment, to occupy our minds when we want to clear them of the clogged tensions of the day. But stories, as they have been used by the wise of the past, by the wise of our own day, stories have a way of giving us strength and giving us insight, particular kinds of insight of how to deal with people. Hasidim tell the tale of Israel, the great master, the Baal Shem, that whenever the people of his day were being persecuted and when were in danger, he would go to a particular place in the forest, and he would light a fire in a particular manner, and he would recite a particular formula of prayer, and the evil which threatened the people would be averted. And in the next generation, the great leader of Hasidim, the Magid of Meserich by the name of Dov Ber, whenever his people were threatened by persecution, by danger, he would go to a particular place in the forest, and he would light the fire in the particular way, but he had forgotten the particular formula of prayer. But somehow, the power of his person was still there. And somehow the danger was averted. And in the third generation, a man named Moshe Lev of Sassof was the great leader of the Hasidim. And when danger threatened his people, he would go to the particular place in the forest, and he would say, "My God, I no longer know how to light the fire. I no longer know the words of the prayer." And somehow, as he spoke these words, the danger was averted. And finally, in the last generation, a man by the name of Israel Regin, the leader of his day, he no longer knew the place in the forest, much less how to light the fire, much less the formula of prayer. So he would sit at home in his armchair. He would close his eyes and concentrate on his prayer. And he would say to God, "Dear God, I no longer know the formula, nor the magical way of lighting the fire, nor do I know any longer the place in the forest I must go. And somehow, all I can do is to tell you the story of my fathers, the great masters." And the story was enough. The power of a story. It's a noted fact among anthropologists that the primitive peoples invest great power in their stories. A teacher of mine, Clyde Cluckholm, used to say that among the Navajos that he had studied, there was a proverb which went that a good story protects life and family and person. How does it do this? How does a story have power? Simply in this way. The man who has charisma, the man who has spiritual power, whose eyes have the look of wisdom and who draws from you your own strength so that you can express it in your lives, this kind of rare person, it has within him the source of strength. And those who are fortunate enough to come in contact with a Baal Shem Tov, or with a Buddha, or with a Jesus, these men who have the privilege of the immediate experience know that their lives are being transformed by it. But what of those who are not so fortunate to be with one of these special people? By retelling the story, we participate somehow in the strength. We recognize that there is more to man than is on the surface. More than that is, if only the man had the power to allow his soul to peer through. There is strength there, and deep joy, and profound understanding. And by participating in the story, the truth of the original moment, we sense unexpected, latent powers within us. These somehow give us, this somehow gives us a new confidence in ourselves, a new sense of our own worth. But there's more yet to a story. Most of us live on the level of common sense, on a kind of pedestrian plateau, where we are moved by what we see, and we question our world in the terms of the conventional wisdom. We don't allow ourselves to consider the possibility that life may be simply chaos, confusion, convulsed, it may have no meaning, that all of our plans and all of our hopes may be doomed to failure because we have gambled on a kind of reasonableness to life, on an idea of progress or of hope or world government which has no chance of success. Each of us lives on a level as if we were civilized, rational, reasonable human beings. We like to think of ourselves as logical persons, as common sense kinds of people. But you know, that's not all there is to life. There are depths and there are heights. There are the depths of passion and the heights of exaltation. And deep down, the psychologists have taught us, Dr. Freud has taught us, has he not, that most of what we think of as reason is in fact not reason at all, but rationalization, self-justification. That most of the basic commitments we make, we do not make because we have logically laid them bare and thought them out and examined all the alternatives. We make them not with our minds, but with our souls. We are so built, so conditioned, that somehow we respond passionately to certain attitudes, to certain feelings, to certain values. And though most of us do not care to admit the irrationality of most of our commitments, it's our soul rather than our mind that controls man. Now, in the history of Western thought, the Greeks, the great Greek philosophers, gave us a legacy in which they insisted that the mind somehow controls life. The greatest man was the philosopher, the man who dispassionately and without any sense of the irrationality of life would judge what he sees, make sense of it, and so govern his life that it made sense. There have been another group of men, the prophets of Judah, figures like Israel Baal Shem Tov, who said, life makes no sense to the mind. It's too profound. It's too contorted. There's too much to be comprehended within any logical postulate. All that man can do is to respond to the Word of God, or to respond to with his own inner being. Open yourself up. Feel, care, love. Don't analyze. Because analysis is deceiving. The cold, calculating way is a destructive way. It'll build you better machines with which to destroy life, but it can't help you become a better man with which to master your relationships in life. Admit the irrationality which exists at the very base of the human spirit. The Israel Baal Shem Tov and his followers, the Hasidim, try to do in their day, in terms of an almost medieval world, what many of our writers and many of our painters and many of our musicians are trying to do in our day. For we too have come to a point in time where we mistrust the mind. The mind of men has built the machines which can destroy the life of mankind. The mind of man can perform efficiently acts of mass murder. The mind of man can dispassionately and cruelly consign millions of people to death. And so our artists have tried to take light and break it up for us so we see not the surface of things, but the incongruities of things, the unexpected meetings of color and of shape, and look on life somewhat as less rational than we like to believe it to be. And our musicians have taken the scale, the full-bodied, familiar scale, where all the harmonies are neat and balanced, and they have broken them open for us. And they've insisted on the disharmonies and on the uncertain juxtapositions of sound. And our writers have taken language and they've broken it apart. And they've insisted that if a man says something to you which seems reasonable, beware of it. because life is not fundamentally reasonable. Look at the quixotic. Look at the uncertain. Look within yourself. You have moments of calmness. But you have moments when anger wells up. You have moments of self-discipline, but you have moments of fear and trembling. You know sometimes that you should not love someone, that that someone will be bad for you, but you love nevertheless. None of us is master of his emotions. None of us is master truly of himself. The Baal Shem Tov and his followers, the Hasidim, tried to take life, tried to take the surface of life and to break it open. They talked always of what they called klipot, shells. They said everything is encased. The spirit of man is encased in his flesh, in his appetite. Break it open, and what do you find? A light. You find love. You find capacity. You find talent. But culture and fear and uncertainty and the need to survive and the jungle has led man to encase himself so that what you see is not the possible man, but the man who is tight and fearful. Look at nature. What do you see? The ordinary man sees trees. The ordinary man sees buildings. But there are no trees out there. There are specific trees. And if you look at the tree, what can you see? You can see its power to grow, to take the air and to purify it, the power of the tree to suggest to you the great beauty of the creator of that tree, the miracle of life itself. If we only break open that the labels and the fears which encase it, us from our world, our world is suddenly alive, bright, gay, full of possibility and full of meaning. And that was their hope, to live in such a life. But to break this world open for us, they had to, in a sense, shock the people around them. And so their stories are filled with stories of demons and stories of sorcerers and stories of wizards and stories of dibuks, of the possession of men by other men. Stories full of what we would call superstition. And yes, they are. They were superstitious folk. But these stories are not idle stories. They are stories which were designed to try and make a generation understand that what appears on the surface is not the sum of reality. That below the surface and above the surface, in man's fears and in man's hopes, in God and in the appetite, the satanic within us, is a reality with which we must come somehow to grips, which we must admit. And if we can admit it, we can rejoice in it. It gives depth and possibility to life. Well, I've talked to you in terms of theory. Let me simply tell you a Hasidic story. It's about a young man by the name of Arya. Arya was precocious, bright, brilliant even. Arya was the most precocious young Talmud scholar in all of Eastern Europe. His fame preceded him. Wherever he went, people flocked to see this quiz kid, this great young genius. But Arya knew that there were levels of learning which he had not mastered. He knew what was in the books. Everything that was in the Jewish library he had mastered. But he knew that there was a language to nature. He knew that there was a secret language which had to do with the relationships of people to each other. And this was the language that he wanted. He knew that there was only one place he could go to be taught the language of the birds, the language of animals, the secret languages of life, and that was to the Baal Shem Tov himself. And so, feeling very proud of himself, certain that the Baal Shem would agree to teach him this because of his genius, the language, the secret languages of life, Arya took a carriage and went the many miles to the little town in which the Baal Shem lived. And the Baal Shem was that day teaching his disciples around the table. And he entered the room and he expected to be greeted warmly and to be made welcome, but not a head turned toward him. No one looked up. He had heard that the Baal Shem could see without seeing. He felt he must know I am here. Surely he will make some mention of my presence. And no mention was made. And the lesson was completed, and all of the disciples left the room, and the Baal Shem went up to his chamber, and the man, this young fellow, was left alone, desperately hurt. No one had paid attention. Had his fame not preceded him? He would have left the room if he had not been so determined somehow to learn the lessons which the Baal Shem had to teach. He waited, and he waited. People came and people went, and no one paid the least attention. And finally, he heard that preparations were being made in the yard to bring the carriage, the Baal Shem, to take him to another village. He thought, they'll leave me behind. He was desperate. He didn't know what to do. The Baal Shem came down the stairs, and others brought his luggage out, and they piled into the carriage, and they were about to take off on their voyage, when suddenly one of the servants who was on the box of the carriage motioned almost offhandedly for the young man to jump up on the carriage and to go with him. And they traveled through the day, and they came to an inn, according to the story. And the Baal Shem went up to his rooms, and no one still paid any attention to the young man. He was allowed to sleep in the straw in the stable. He was desperate. He'd hoped against hope. Where was his presence? Where was his fame? Would not anyone pay attention to his need? That night, he suddenly saw a light in the window of the Baal Shem's room, and he crept up the stairs. The door was open, and he saw the presence of the master surrounded by a halo of light, and he was overwhelmed by this sight, and he fell down into a dead swoon. But he thought he heard the Baal Shem say, "My son, I know why you have come." The morning came, and the Baal Shem came down the stairs and went into his carriage, and again he was simply motioned to come and take a seat in the carriage. But as they traveled that day through a forest, the Baal Shem motioned him over to a seat next to him, and he said, "My son, I know why you are here. You want to learn the secret languages of life. Draw close to me. I'll whisper this knowledge in your ear, for you are worthy of receiving it." And the Baal Shem spoke to him about the mysteries of life, the secret languages of the animals and of nature. And lo and behold, as he spoke on, and as this man, Aryeh, listened to this secret lore, with his other ear, he began to hear the animals of the forest and the birds flying overhead, and he could make out what they were saying. The secret language was being told him, and he was being informed. He was captivated. With one ear, he was listening to the deeper wisdom. With the other ear, he was having proof of the value of that wisdom. But suddenly the Baal Shem stopped. And the minute he stopped speaking, the young man could no longer understand the chirpings of the birds and the baying of the animals. They were now only animal sounds. He looked up aghast, shocked. And the Baal Shem said to him, "My son, you're a very greedy human being. God reveals his glory only to those who can truly concentrate on one thing." Now, on one level, the story is simply a wonder tale about the magical and miraculous powers of the Baal Shem. On another level, it can be trivialized to simply the lesson we give to our children: concentrate on what you're doing. Don't have the radio and the TV and the telephone going and try to do your schoolwork at the same time. You won't achieve it. But on another level, you have here the philosophy, really, of the whole Hasidic movement. And that is, if you concentrate long enough on one act of worship of God, on your relationship to God or to another human being, you will find depths within depths. If you live extensively, as most people live, moving from experience to experience, from stimulus to stimulus, from speech to speech, from conversation to idle talk to conversation, from book to book, from painting to painting, your life will have thinness, expanse, but it'll never have depth. You have never explored the many layers of living. Concentrate on one thing. The Hasidim concentrated on prayer. And into the, it was not the words of prayer which meant something to them, but the spirit which one must bring to prayer. And as they prayed with greater and greater intensity, they had the sense that the world opened up before them, that they were traveling from their synagogues to God. Something was happening within them. Now, translate this into our own life. When you talk with another human being, as most of us talk to most other human beings, without looking them in the eye, with one ear attuned to the conversation that's going elsewhere in the room, and part of the mind worrying on whether something is boiling over in the kitchen, or whether we're going to receive the call that we're so eager to receive, the conversation passes. We grow older, we get that much closer to the grave. But in terms of meaning, there's very little meaning. In terms of our being changed by this meeting, or the person we're talking to being changed by it, there's no change. We leave as we have come, none the better for it. But the people with whom we love, the people with whom we spend time, which is time that is concentrated on them. We say about our children, do we not? It's not how much time we spend with them, but the quality of the time that we spend with them. And what do we mean? That if we concentrate on them and are patient and silent and listen, they learn from us and we learn from them almost without words. We learn something about love and something about relationship. But if we're always distracted, we can spend a great deal of time with them, but the time has no meaning. You may as well have been elsewhere. There are levels of life which open only to concentration. And the Hasidic emphasis was the emphasis on the single moment, on the single meeting, on the single-minded, single-faith relationship with God. Oh, they would have laughed at our lives, cut up, apocopated, as variegated as they are. Where are you running, you moderns? What are you seeking? Wisdom? Are you going to read every book that has ever been published? Are you going to listen to every piece of music that has ever been set down? Are you going to see every painting that's ever been set to canvas? Do you see what you have the chance to see? Or does your eye move so quickly, your ear move on so quickly, you yourself move beyond the moment so quickly that no moment has a deep and profound meaning for you? And as a rabbi, I must say this, that worship fails in the 20th century because we are not willing to concentrate on the moment of worship. It's between breakfast and lunch. It's between family and family. It's not a moment in itself. The Hasidim prayed for 3 hours before they came into the synagogue to pray their morning prayer so they might be attuned, spiritually attuned to the moment. They had freed their minds of the mundane, of the routine, of the commonplace, of the tensions of their families and of their day. Perhaps we lack this luxury, certainly we do. But wouldn't we all be the wiser? Wouldn't we all be the better? If there, those things which were important to us in our lives and those relationships which are significant had a depth, an intensity to them, if we gave time to them that we do not now give and explored the depth, the possibility, the intensity, which is possible in relationships. A story with which I close. The Hasidim, as you know, were fearful for the most part of talking with their women. Women dealt, they felt, with idle things and with trifles. They would distract them from the significant moment. But the Baal Shem was not such a man. It's reported of him in the Shivchei HaBesht, in the book of which I spoke. One of his disciples said, "What should I do when I am distracted by the passage of a beautiful woman?" And the Baal Shem's answer was very simple. look at her carefully, and look at her again. Be amazed by her beauty. And as you become amazed, you'll see beyond the beauty of God who created her. And you'll appreciate something of the graciousness of the world which is yours.